From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author David Arnold, whose new novel is The Electric Kingdom, published by Viking Books for young readers. David Arnold is the New York Times bestselling author of Mosquito Land, Kids of Appetite, and The Strange Fascinations of Noah Hypnotic, which has been optioned for film by Paramount. He has won the Southern Book Prize and the Great Lakes Book Award and was named a Publishers Weekly Flying Start for his debut. His books have been translated into over a dozen languages. He lives in Lexington, Kentucky, with his wife and son. Here's a little information about the Electric Kingdom. When a deadly fly flu sweeps the globe, it leaves a shell of the world that once was. Among the survivors are 18-year-old Nico and her dog, on a voyage devised by Nico's father to find a mythical portal, a young artist named Kit, raised in an old abandoned cinema, and the enigmatic Deliverer. As swarms of infected flies roam the earth, these few survivors navigate the woods of post-apocalyptic New England, meeting others along the way, each on their own quest to find life and love in a world gone dark. I began by asking David Arnold if he had written the extremely engaging opening, which pulls together a lot of threads that will become important later. I wondered if he had written that opening at the very beginning as he worked on The Electric Kingdom, or if that's something that he circled back to and wrote after he had finished a draft. So that's where we start. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The format of The Electric Kingdom changed drastically over the process of writing it. And it took years to write. So I would have kind of an idea of what I would think the format would be. And it actually, for a while near the beginning, it was, I don't know if you've read Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell.
A long time ago. Yeah.
It had that, what is that? It's sort of like a Russian nesting doll kind of format where you start telling a story and then you stop halfway and then you start another story and you stop halfway. And then there's a middle story that's whole. And then you kind of work your way back out so that it closes with the very beginning. Like you finish the first story at the very end. And I had this idea that that's what this story would be. And that, so that prologue where it opens in a traffic jam, there was an entire second part that I was going to close the book with. And then, you know, the book is told from Nico's point of view, Kit's point of view, and the Deliverer's point of view. And in the early drafts, it was split up in that same way. So it was like it opened in that traffic jam, and then we had Nico's story, and then we had Kit. It didn't alternate the way it does now. And that really largely is credit to my editor, who at one point was like, you're sacrificing story for format, which is never a good... That's never right.
Sort of yeah. Like because of how clever it felt or.
Yeah, I was forcing it. I was trying, you know, when you read Cloud Atlas, you kind of, it makes sense for that book the way, you know, and it's this sort of brilliantly put together narrative structure that I was trying to, I don't know. I had this idea that I could do it too. And maybe there is a story down the line that would lend itself to that, but this was not the one. And ultimately, once I let go of that, it kind of let the whole story just breathe in a way that it hadn't before.
It's interesting, though, because one of your blurbs, or maybe it was a review, did call it a post-apocalyptic nesting doll of a tale, which is pretty cool because that was initially what you were thinking of. So you were able to get rid of that and still get that blurb.
So. Yeah, exactly. No, and I love that that was a takeaway. But yeah, earlier it was, I was trying to do that with format and it was not having it. So.
Yeah. Okay. So without giving anything away, I will just say that the scene that I was mentioning about the traffic jam ends with this stunning vision that will affect the rest of the story. So now I know that your format changed as you went, but was that vision always a part of the book as you worked? And did that keep you grounded in some way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the book takes place just under 20 years after the end of the world. And so, and the entire book is set in that world. And I very much wanted the opening of the book to feel more like in a world that we were familiar with. It needed to feel more grounded, as you said. And also, I mean, I guess it the image that you're speaking about, I assume you mean the billboard and sort of the way that that all comes together. Yeah, that was always part of it. I knew that I wanted that image to sort of be an anchor for the story. Now, what was on the billboard changed pretty like as the story changed, but that idea kind of stayed throughout for sure.
Okay. Now, your novel has a pandemic of sorts that has to do with flies. How did you first imagine this? And when flies came to you, was it sort of an aha moment? I'm going to do that. Or did it start with flies or did it start with a disease and then flies came in?
The short answer would be it started with a disease and then I had to figure out what that looked like. I'm the kind of reader who can doesn't necessarily need much plot. And so as a writer, I find myself, I'll have some trusted friends who read for me who will be like this, you know, here are the things that are working. Inevitably, what comes back is you need to find a way to raise some stakes. I was happy to kind of let this be a tale of these people kind of navigating this new world, but there was very little danger. And some of my early readers were like, there's got to be something, you know, you got to give us something. And I had kind of alluded, you know, one of the things that I love about post-apocalyptic literature, I very much see post-apocalyptic literature as and storytelling in general as different than apocalyptic storytelling. So like a great example of apocalyptic storytelling, a recent novel that I loved was Wanderers by Chuck Wendig. To me, that's apocalyptic because it's describing how the world ended or changed in some dramatic way. And it's more about how it all happened. Post-apocalyptic literature shifts the conversation onto the people who survived. So it's not about what happened. It's about who it happened to. Right. Which just sort of is in like generally that's more interesting to me. I gravitate toward more character driven stories like that. And so like Severance is a great example by Ling Ma or Station 11. These stories that are about, you know, and it may touch on how the world ended or what went down, but it's not really about that. It's about this new world and the people that are surviving. And that was the story I wanted to tell. So to answer your question, I knew there was some sort of dramatic thing that wiped out the world. I wasn't really concerned about that, and so then it became, you know, I was looking for a way to kind of kill two birds with one stone. If I could describe how the world ended and also have whatever that thing was be some sort of still present danger in the current post-apocalyptic landscape, I could kind of solve both problems. And so I don't really remember when the flies started. It was not an aha moment. Like looking back, I'm not really sure when they really kind of became part of the story. I did at one point realize that just having swarms of flies didn't feel quite like enough. And a friend of mine, another author, Jeff Sentner, was like, well, you could have them be like a crossbreeding experiment. And I thought that's it. Have it just, and you just mention it, you know, it doesn't have to, you don't have to make a meal out of it. And, so just mention this sort of honeybee crossbreeding experiment gone wrong. And that was enough, really.
Yeah. Now, I almost didn't want to ask this question because it's so easy. But seriously, you have to ask about the coincidence of an actual pandemic coming in. I'm assuming that you had finished this book before COVID hit this country.
Yeah.
So that must have been kind of freaky and weird.
Yeah, it was very strange. And a couple of things, you know, like I said about the difference between apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic, I do wonder if this had been, you know, a pandemic book where it was about a pandemic that had devastated the world. I do wonder if I would have tried to push the publication or something. I don't know. I'm not saying I definitely would have, but I would have considered it a lot more. But because the book really isn't about that, it is weird for sure. And when this all first started happening, I called my agent. I was like, do we need to have a conversation about the, you know, because they'd already, as you said, the book was done and Penguin had already picked the publication date of February 2021, you know, months before COVID came to America, or at least before we think it did. And So yeah, I had that kind of a question early on, and he kind of said, well, let's wait and see what happens. This may blow over. As it turned out, it didn't at all, obviously. And it's now become sort of, we don't really know, you know, there is a new normal, obviously. And, but yeah, because the book wasn't about a pandemic, I wasn't super concerned. It really is about, I hope that it provides hope and kind of an escape.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no. No, it was just interesting, you know, I mean, it's just, but I think we think about these things because these things are in the forefront, and it just happened right now, but,
Yeah, it was weird timing for sure. And there was a week or so there where I was like, I don't know what to do. And, but I kind of had people that were talking to me and reminding me what the book was. And yeah, so it very quickly became a decision where I thought, no, let's just leave it. I think this is, the timing should be hopefully helpful.
Yeah. On the other hand, I will say that, YA I don't know if I would call it as a genre, as an audience, as an intention, against a backdrop like this, feels right. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts about that. You know, just like YA readers are going to relate to, I don't know, a backdrop of devastation. Am I oversimplifying the YA reader?
No, I mean, I love this question. I love that you brought this up because I have a lot of thoughts. And what's great about it is there is, you know, I have close friends who write young adult literature who have very different thoughts. And we have these great discussions about what it is that we do and why we do it. And they have different thoughts on it. There isn't, you know, a right way of doing it. But I very much, you know, I've never sat down and thought, okay, it's time to write a young adult novel now. I'm lucky that I found a publisher who has supported me and my stories and has kind of given me this sort of free space to create stories that I want to tell. And that publisher is a young adult publisher, and I'm thrilled to be published, you know, on that shelf. There's some of the bravest writing in literature is happening in young adult world. And that's fantastic. I'm thrilled to be here, I guess is what I'm saying. But
right.
Yeah, it was never an intentional decision for me to sit down and write a young adult novel. And I don't know what it says about me that my most honest and my most natural voice sort of leans toward the teenage experience. I do viscerally remember my teen years and the sort of coming of age, those years where you thought you understood the world and now it's becoming something else. And you want the world to understand you, but you're also becoming something else. And all of those feelings, I'm still very, you know, I'm almost 40, but I feel very connected to that age group. Even when I, you know, back when school visits and book festivals in person were a thing. And we, you know, I would much rather hang out with the teen audience, you know? So I'm thrilled to be here, but it's never been an intention. And I love that you didn't call it a genre. I bristle at the notion of, and I don't get angry about it. I'm not trying to like start fights or anything, but the idea of an age group being a genre, I think is ridiculous. The prescriptive element of that, I don't like at all. I'm not writing books for anybody. You know, I write books about hopefully everybody. And yes, it is generally teenager protagonists. And especially in Electric Kingdom, you know, there's something weird happening with a lot of the adults in the book. And so it is carried by teens. And, but, you know, I wrote this book not under contract, largely because it was a big pivot for me, genre wise, in more of a sci-fi post-apocalyptic space, which I'd never done before. And I didn't want the sort of looming, I mean, I don't want to put it in like a negative or like I'm ungrateful for a book deal, but I didn't want a book deal on the front end for this book. I wanted to know that I could write it first.
Well, it must also help to have the independence of your own creativity while you're working it out, rather than somebody telling you what they want it to look like right from the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really lucky with Penguin and my editor. I've had two editors under the same publisher now, and it's always been we're in the same sort of, I always picture it as like whitewater rapids, and we're in the same boat, and we really are just trying to make the book as good as it can be. But there's never been like you need to do it this way or you need to do it that way. It's always Yeah, I've never felt forced to do anything, but yes, there is sort of hanging over your head. I've written two books under contract now, and one of those actually turned out to be a fine experience and was not a problem at all, mainly because it was me. it was my most personal, most me book that I've written. And so it was easy in as much as writing any novel could be easy. But the other one was a kind of a nightmare, and ultimately it became a book that I learned to love and figured out how to write, but it was not a process that early on, at least, that I enjoyed. So I knew with this book, I wanted to write it not under contract, but I say all that to say, when I wrote it, especially The Electric Kingdom, there was never a moment where I said, okay, I need to make this more young adult. How can I make this a young adult novel? I mean, in the early stages, you've got, as you say, this traffic jam with two adult protagonists having a married conversation. And then you've got later on, one of the three main characters is an adult. And so, yeah, I never really thought about or at least not in the first draft, I never really thought about where it was going to go. And,
yep.
That's a long answer to a question that I can't remember. So I hope that I answered it.
You did. Okay. Sometimes the questions are just to get us to an interesting place and not necessarily for that specific thing. I want to ask you a couple of craft oriented things. Sometimes, as a writer, I think it's very hard to offer information when you are tied to a certain character's point of view. Even if you're not writing in the first person, sometimes the third person is very close to the character. So I love seeing creative ways of managing this. And I loved this moment in the book. I'm just going to read a sentence, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah, of
course. And I'm actually excerpting a little bit. So Nico found a tree in the distance and imagined a stranger's eye peeking out from behind it. What would this person see? And then it goes on to describe what it would look like if someone were standing behind that tree, which Nico is not. And I loved that. It was just kind of this interesting creative moment of just sort of like letting us see more than where she is situated. So there's that. But also, speaking of point of view, I love the juxtaposition of the sort of more mysterious character, that the deliverer, being the only one whose mind is in the first person narrative. That was really cool to me. So I wondered if you want to talk about either or both of those two moments.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny because I'm reading a book right now by Alex Garland called The Beach, which is not a new book. I mean, and they made it into a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio back in the early 2000s. But I only recently discovered Alex Garland. He has a TV show on Hulu that came out near the beginning of quarantine called Devs.
Okay.
Which, for anybody who loves sort of heady sci-fi, I would love to talk about Ted Chiang, by the way. Ted Chiang's work was a big influence on this book. But
oh, cool. Okay.
If you're into that kind of stuff, this show Devs is fantastic. But that kind of got me into what else has Alex Garland done place? And that was, so I'm reading The Beach, but there's this great scene where he's described, I believe it's first person, the book is, but there's this great scene where they're climbing down a mountain and he's telling it as if it's a memory. And he even says, he acknowledges in the book, the first person character says, there's no reason for me to remember it this way, but here's how I remember it. And he goes on to describe it as if he's like, you know, looking down at himself. And I picked up on that because you've read from that excerpt, I do that same thing where I'm often thinking, well, how can I not just describe this, but how can I do this in an interesting way? And it sometimes lends itself to a more surreal narrative. In my third novel, The Strange Fascinations of Noah Hypnotic, that book is in first person. And there are all sorts of scenes where I have him having sort of out of body experiences, looking down on himself. But I'm also able to describe his entire bedroom that way. So yeah, there are kind of like cheats that you can do that end up not being cheats, that somehow enhance the book itself as well. Or at least I hope that that's true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think they're cheats. I think they're interesting. I think they're interesting ways of presenting. And also it says something about the character, that the character thinks this way.
Right. Yeah. And it also adds, especially with that scene in particular, like this sort of element of, well, what if somebody is looking at them from behind a tree?
Of course.
There's a little bit of a suspense element there as well. I've forgotten the second part of your question.
No, it was just that the deliverer is in the first person.
Right. Yes, that was intentional. And, you know, so you've got Nico and Kit's points of view, and, you know, Nico being 18 and Kit being 12. I've written my second novel, Kids of Appetite, was alternating points of view, both of them in first person. And when I finished that book, I swore I would never do that again. Actually, what I swore was that I would never do alternating points of view again.
Oh, really?
Because it was just so difficult, not just to keep track of, but then I would often feel myself getting lost in their voices. And so then I thought, well, of course the readers, you know, so, but when I came to this book, I thought, okay, I'm going to do it in third person so I don't have that same problem. And I do think it is largely, if you're doing alternating points of view, I'll speak for myself, third person worked was just a much better way to work in that sort of narrative. But yeah, when it came time to tell the deliverer's story, you know, the deliverer lives in this house on top of a mountain with electricity and is omnipotent and omniscient. And really the deliverer's character is what makes the book sci-fi. If you remove the deliverer's character from the narrative, it's a straight up post-apocalyptic novel. The deliverer adds this sort of sci-fi element where you're not really sure what's going on. And I wanted not just the character to feel jarring, but the reading of the character to feel jarring. And so that became, I was like, well, what if the whole book is in third person except for the deliverer's chapters? And I love that you picked that up. And I hope that that was compelling. And it was certainly fun to write. Just it's such a different feel from the rest of the book.
It is, but it's also just sort of against what you would expect, because we do know all these other characters, but we don't get directly inside of their heads. And the deliverer being more enigmatic, it's interesting that that's the one character whose head we're literally in.
You know? Right. And it was a fine line to walk. There were a number of times where my editor would read something that I'd written and be like, you can't, like, you know, there is, as you said, it is more of an enigmatic character where you don't really know what's going on. There were moments of me giving away too much.
Uh-huh. I'm sure that would be hard to.
So yeah, but it was just a really fun challenge. And yeah.
Let's see. You have some scenes where, you know, these flies are literally chasing people. And I was reading this one scene and I was like, you know, I've attempted the occasional chase scene in my own work. I find it hard to write chase. And I think sometimes what actually is happening is something that we've seen a number of times can devolve into cliche. Yours was not a cliche. I am not saying that. But I think that when a cliche exists, it's easy to fall into writing in that cliche, you know, using that as our prototype. And I think that makes it harder to do a good job. And your chase scenes weren't that, you know, it was really fun. They're not like hightailing it and knocking over hot dog stands and, you know, it's hard to explain. But anyway, do you have any thoughts about anything that I've just said?
No, for sure I do. Action sequences in general, whether it's chasing or just trying to describe a quick thing that's happening, is always hard for me because, you know, as opposed to like a film or a TV show where you just show it, you don't have to, you know, they're just doing it and it's there and they've done it. And okay, great. The thing about reading that, for me at least, it gets very tiresome just reading like descriptions of what's happening. This is why fight sequences are hard for me to read and hard for me to write, and chase sequences are hard for me to read and hard for me to write. I just get bored reading about this happened and this happened, descriptions of things happening. So I'm always trying to figure out ways to tie it to something in the character's past. So I don't know if this is the one that you're thinking of in particular, but there is a scene in The Electric Kingdom where Nico realizes, well, I don't want to spoil anything. She's done a thing that she wishes she hadn't done, and that is going to, there are going to be very big visual consequences of this thing that she's done. And she realizes, I shouldn't have done that, and now I need to get as far away from here as possible. And that scene was difficult to write because it started with like a couple of sentences of me describing her running through the woods. And I was just so bored.
Well, to some extent, part of what's interesting in a chase scene is what's chasing instead of what's being chased.
Right.
But if you're in the perspective of the person who's running away, you don't get a lot of that. So I thought you did an interesting job of offering us.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And it ended up being, that ended up becoming one of the chapters in the book that I'm the most proud of and that I love the most, because I started imagining, you know, so Nico has, days before this moment, has said goodbye to her father, and her dad had sort of sent her on this mission, which may or may not be completely foolhardy. She's still not sure. But he's back in their farmhouse in the middle of the woods, and they have this deck, which I had already kind of described. And so I thought, well, what if she, as she's running, imagines him standing on this deck, looking out over the woods and thinking, where is Nico in all of this? And then, okay, well, maybe we can even go back further and have these descriptions of what her parents used to do when they tucked her in at night and the things that they hoped for her. And you kind of dive into the history of the person as she's running. And that makes the run and the chase all that more compelling, because you see that she's thinking of not just the things that have led to this moment of her running, but the things that have led to this moment of her being in this place at all.
Right.
And to me, that's far more compelling to read and a lot more fun to write.
Yeah. I mean, you can only come up with so many metaphors for a heart beating really hard.
Right. You let out a breath you didn't know you were holding.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guilty of writing that sentence, you know, just like most writers.
Well, sometimes you need those sentences, damn it.
I know, you do. You do.
Well, you've just mentioned this about Nico striking out. And Kit also goes on a journey away from the home that he has always sort of associated as his home. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about why we love, and I do too, a quest story.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've sort of accidentally written three of them now. I've written four novels, and three of them very easily are categorized under the quest story. And, you know, I don't know what it is about that. I don't know what it is. We talked earlier about there's no wrong or right way. And I have so many friends who do things certain ways, whether it's keeping track of word counts or attending seminars, you know, or even if you want to go back further to like education, you know, getting masters. And I've never been a student of it. I find that when I study it too much, it freaks me out. And I get in my head about all the things I'm doing wrong. And there may come a day where I feel like becoming a student of this is a more responsible thing to do, and would somehow, you know, would serve to make me a better writer. But where I am now, it just, when I've tried to look at the why, it makes me not want to write anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of have just backed away from that, and the acknowledgement of that might just be where I am right now, and that's fine. So I try not to ask too many questions. You know, with my third novel, again, The Strange Fascinations of Noah Hypnotic is not a quest story, and it isn't, largely because going into it, I was on the heels of writing my second book, which I realized, similarly to my first, is a quest story. So going into my third novel, I was like, I'm not going to write a quest story. And so I didn't. I wasn't thinking about that so much going into The Electric Kingdom. And sure enough, a quest story found its way. So I don't really know. I'm not really sure what that is. And I'm a little too nervous to really investigate what that is.
Yeah. I would also add what you said before about going to school, studying this stuff. I think part of it does make you a better writer. I did get an MFA, and I thought it was valuable for my writing. I think, too, it's valuable for teaching. I think a lot of people learn how to talk about this stuff through their programs, right? But I think many, 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 many writers that haven't got MFAs are wonderful, wonderful writers.
So. It's partly my own stubborn. My DNA is that I was in music for years. And everything was always by ear. And whenever I would try to take classes or try to learn how to read music, or I would just get really mad. And I don't know what that's a character fault of mine, that if I could get over it, then, and I think it applies to writing, that because obviously so many great writers and friends of mine who have gotten MFAs, I have no doubt that their writing is enhanced and is better for it. And I don't know. There's something in me that gets mad, or I don't. Yeah, that's something I'd like to achieve. Get over that.
It could be that you're recognizing a certain tendency to overanalyze if it's offered to you or something like that. Maybe it's for the best.
Yeah, I was a bad student. Yeah, and I think that's really what it is. It feels like it becomes to feel like homework. And I was never a good student. I never enjoyed school. I love writing, and I don't want it to feel like homework. Yeah.
I don't think you need to go to school. Nobody's saying that. can we just talk for a minute about Harry? I loved Nico's rapport with her dog, Harry. And I love this moment. Can I just read one more little thing?
For sure.
Okay. One knee on the ground, she put her hand on the back of Harry's neck and took comfort in the knowledge that she did not have to tell him to be quiet, just as she did not have to tell herself to be quiet. It was, be quiet. And they were. That was like poetry to me. I loved that. I just loved that it was be quiet. It you know, the whole sense of what's happening right now is be quiet. And I loved that description. So
thank you. Well, I mean, it takes years for me to write a novel. I feel like I could write a novel in much, much less time, but I do focus so much on the sentence. The musicality of the sentences is really important to me, and that takes a long time. And so I appreciate you saying that. I mean, that, you know, it, again, I do wonder if that has something to do with the years of music, just focusing on the meter and the way that the words work together with each other. And when I'm reading, I don't worry so much about, I've come up with this sort of, I've realized this thing about myself that I have and I think we all do to a certain extent, a hierarchy of values. As we're reading, the things that we look for in books that make us love a book, or the things that we really can't stand in a book. And ultimately over time, you kind of build up this hierarchy of values. And so for me, like, sentences, like on a sentence level, the wording is much more important than pacing. So I can, when I'm reading a book, if the pacing is slow, that's fine if the words are beautiful. and likewise, when I'm writing, I'm happy to sacrifice pacing a little bit, obviously, without getting crazy about it, but sacrifice pacing if it means I can spend a little more time with the musicality of the language.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this is not about the book, but I was on your website and I loved your stop action trailer for the book. How long did that take to make with the paper?
Oh, thank you. That was a quarantine project.
Okay.
I had come to the end of a draft. It may have been the final. I'm terrible at my own timelines. It's hard for me to remember some of this stuff, but I know it happened last fall. Yeah, I think I know that it happened last fall. Yeah, it took about a week, you know, so I cut out, I spend time. It's very therapeutic. It's, you know, I don't have a lot of hobbies. I very much am a very type A kind of, once I sink my teeth into a creative project, it's blinders to everything else. And it's just that project. And so I think I had come to either the end of revising, or at least revising a section, and thought I need a break. But it also kind of allows me to work. It's still part of the project. It's not the writing of the book, but it's, I know it'll, you know, be promotion later on. And but it's a creative space and a fun thing. So I'd spend probably 2 or 3 days just cutting. I've ordered a ton of different color paper and cutting it all out. And then a few days of the stop motion. It started because my son and I were making stop motion movies. He's really into that stuff. And,
did you just use your phone, or what are you videoing with?
Yeah, there's an app called Stop Motion Studio.
Oh, wow.
That I got to do stuff with him. And then it kind of has become, I mean, I've done a few smaller things. But that was, yeah, that was the biggest project I've done on my own, and it was therapeutic and fun. And, it was a blast putting it together.
That's great. Now, I do always like to ask what people have been reading lately that they might recommend to listeners. And you mentioned Alex Garland, and you said you wanted to mention somebody else too. So let's talk about that now.
Yeah, sure. Well, first I'll mention When We Were Infinite by a friend and author, Kelly Lloyd Gilbert. It's just, you want to talk about a character-driven, sort of heartbreaking, beautiful language book. I'm a big fan of Kelly's, and this is her third novel, and it's fantastic, and I highly recommend it. Ted Chiang is who I mentioned earlier. So really it was, you know, so I had the idea for The Electric Kingdom back in 2013. I was a stay-at-home dad of my newborn son, who is now almost 9. So that's been a bizarre thing.
But, wow.
And it kind of sat in a folder on my computer for a couple of years. And I would have ideas every once in a while. I'd come back and kind of dump them in the folder. But it was that closet with the door closed that you don't want to open up, because it's scary how much stuff is in there and how unorganized it is. And so that was The Electric Kingdom for a few years. And then And also around this time, I would have said that I wasn't a fan of sci-fi. That's just who I was. I would have said realistic stories is really, I'm here to tell the realistic story. I think I had, I mean, other than like Star Wars and like I'd watched the Battlestar Galactica reboot and really loved that. But aside from that, I would have said sci-fi really wasn't for me. And then in early 2016, I think I went to see what I thought was an alien movie. And when I left the theater, I was a completely changed person. And that movie was Arrival, which is still probably my favorite movie of the decade. It just is the most perfect, most gorgeous, most brilliant movie. And credit to Eric Heiser, who wrote the screenplay, because he kind of made the story his own in its own sort of beautiful cinematic way. But that really did lead me to the source material, which was the short story that Arrival is based on, which is called Stories of Your Life by Ted Chiang. And so he has two short story collections, The Stories of Your Life and Others is the first one. And the second one is Exhalation. And both of those books Ted Chiang, I guess, is sort of my North Star, I at least with this style of writing and this sort of heady sci-fi. I think the thing I love the most about his work is that it doesn't feel like anything else. And also, you know, as you're reading his stories, you're not necessarily able to connect all of the threads. I mean, there's a lot happening. He's a genius. Ted Chiang is. And so there's all this stuff happening and you're not really sure what's going on, but you're able to sort of let go and trust that he's connected all of the threads and you can just kind of enjoy the experience. And that was very much, you know, by no means am I anywhere close to Ted Chiang, but that was certainly sort of a thing that I was thinking as I was writing The Electric Kingdom. You know, there's multiple timelines, there's multiple points of view. It's sort of, I'm okay with readers not connecting all the threads so long as they trust that I have. I think Kirk has called it perplexing yet satisfying. And I was like, that's exactly right. That's what I'm going for. I want you to not be entirely sure what's happening, but know that I know what's happening and I've done my editor and I, not me alone by any stretch of the imagination. It was hours and hours of phone calls with my editor trying to Dana Ladig at Viking, trying to piece it all together and make it all. But yes, Ted Chiang was a huge influence on the book and is still one of my favorite writers.
Okay, great. What are you working on next? Have you got something in a draft already or even completed maybe?
So at the beginning of quarantine, started writing. I have two projects happening kind of simultaneously, and I can't really say much about either of them, but I wrote a screenplay. I was working on a book, and then COVID came to America and quarantine happened, and my book didn't make sense anymore. I mean, this is just so many writers went through that same thing where it was like, well, what do we, you know, this thing that you thought was realistic or that would somehow make sense in the world suddenly doesn't. And I started writing this just really fun, very bizarre screenplay, which I'm sort of in the middle of trying to figure out if it'll work as a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. So that's one project. And then I do have another novel that I'm working on. I'm about 20,000 words in. It's got sci-fi elements to it, but it is more of a like contemporary romance. I think it's I would call it like a speculative romance. I can't talk too much about it yet.
No, you shouldn't. That's great. That's fun.
I'm loving them. So,
I always end by asking for advice for writers. And in your case, in your acknowledgments, you write that you spent most of your writing career exploring the metaphorical ways in which art and story can save us. So something about that and also just about reading your book made me feel like you could speak to writers who could use some hope as they pursue this career, which is such a hard career. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that statement, about the metaphorical ways in which art and story can save us, or if you want to take it in another direction. I just thought I'd ask you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, so for years I always said, you know, you have to give yourself permission to suck, which is sort of a really pithy way of saying, you know, you're going to write bad stuff and you have to kind of keep going and nothing, you know, especially when I talk to young writers who maybe are aspiring authors, maybe not, but they're trying to finish something and they can't finish it. They're like, how do you finish it? I'm like, the only way to finish it is to be okay with it sucking for a really long period of time. And you finish it anyway. And, you know, find the thing that you love most that's made in this world, whether it's a painting or a song or a book or whatever, and just know that at some point in the creation of that thing, it sucked. And the creator just kept working on it until it sucked less. So that's what I've said for a long, long time. And I mean, it's still true, but I don't think there's anything like, there's no real nugget of wisdom there. I think that's something that we all kind of know, but maybe you're pinpointing or articulating in a way that hasn't been before. But I think the hierarchy of values thing that I mentioned before is something that that's really a newer idea that I've had. And I think, again, it's not groundbreaking and it's, you know, it doesn't change anything necessarily, except it's made me more aware as I'm reading. It's made me more aware of the things that I love, and then letting go of any guilt as I'm writing about the things that I'm not incorporating or the things that I'm not focusing on, and just allowing myself to say, no, these are the things that are important to me. I like a really ambitious book, and maybe it doesn't clear the fence, but I swung really hard, you know? So like ambition is okay. And, you know, musicality of language is okay. So find the things, you know, whatever those things, and maybe to you as a writer, the things that you, or as a reader, the things that you love are these really detailed descriptions of fight sequences. And that's great. So allow yourself to love that. And allow yourself to be okay with that being your focus when you're writing too, and releasing the guilt of the things that you don't enjoy or you don't love. Because no, you know, it doesn't serve anyone to write something that you're not loving. It's no good for you and it's no good for your readers. So yeah, I think just identifying the things in the books that you read that you love, and then putting those things into your work and letting go of the things that you aren't good at or that you don't enjoy.
Wonderful. That's awesome. All right. Well, I just want to mention again, the name of the book is The Electric Kingdom by David Arnold and published by Viking. And I want to thank you for speaking with me. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Shayla. This was really fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author David Arnold about his new book, The Electric Kingdom, published by Viking Books for Young Readers. You can learn more about his work at davidarnoldbooks.com. You can follow him on Instagram at IamDavidArnold and Twitter at RoofBeam. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, David Arnold. His first inspiration for The Electric Kingdom came to him as he was a stay-at-home dad caring for his newborn son. It was the image of a boarded-up farmhouse in the middle of the woods that was the inspiration that led him to start taking notes. I suggested that maybe his new dad brain was trying to encourage him to rent a cabin as a writing retreat, but he says no, it wasn't that. For him, the farmhouse allowed him to begin thinking about The Electric Kingdom. And years later, he would begin to write it, as you heard in the interview. He invites us to use that same image as a prompt this week. A farmhouse, deep in the woods, boards over the windows. Where does this take you? Think about it and start writing. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. More and more people, yours truly included, are getting vaccinated, and you know, I feel like this is going to start turning the tide, but we still have to be really careful. Try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I hope that you're able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. You may have noticed I have been running some reruns lately, but I am going to be running more new shows again. I was temporarily filling in as producer of a show called Vermont Viewpoint on another radio station, and that's been really fun. But that is temporary. It's coming to a close soon, and I will be making more Write the Book shows available to you, new authors talking about new books. If you enjoy Write the Book, please rate it wherever you find it. And talk about it, share it on social media, all that stuff. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, a lot of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. At that same website, you can also put your email into my mailing list. I don't hammer anybody with a lot of emails, but I am going to start doing some more mailings in the near future. So you can go to my website and fill out the contact form if you'd like to be on the email list. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. That's it for today. Stay well and have a great week.